Good morning or afternoon. This is Gary Kavner here on TRSI. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. This is going to be a quick episode because Michael is terribly, terribly tired today. Michael, how are you?
I hate you. I hate you and everything you stand for.
The thing you've said with the most energy so far this morning.
It's not necessary to share with the viewer, or the listener, I should say, all of the commentary that we have before we begin to record this, Gary, you know? I don't feel like this is a safe space. And I think that in future, I will be far more careful and edited in the conversations I have with you, knowing that there's a chance it's going to be published.
Or you'll fall asleep as soon as this is finished and forget all of this ever happened.
As soon as this is finished.
Because you're just so tired.
As soon as this is finished, I'm going for my walk, which I walk for 5 kilometers, and then I shall come home and make lunch.
Ah. And then you can have some nice hot cocoa and go back to bed.
I don't like cocoa and I don't like hot chocolate.
Aw, such a fussy child.
What is wrong with you? I mean, there's obviously something. There's something wrong with you. I mean, I'm not saying, like, just in a general sense, because we all know there's something wrong with you at base level, but there's something particularly wrong with you today.
No, I just felt like doing that to you, and I knew you couldn't stop me. So I did.
So was this a kind of a manifestation in realpolitik of realpolitik? This is power politics happening in live action.
Yeah, in live podcast form. The strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must.
Yeah, you love that, don't you? You do. That should be put on your front door or on your forehead. Printed.
Just have it cut into the wall of my door. Just the weak should fear the strong.
Yeah, well, it's better than having it cut into your forehead with a sharp knife and a Stanley blade. But anyway, what's in the news?
So I suppose the major thing, a lot of news about immigration, a lot of news about the European elections. The government is doing everything it can to ensure that its own candidates are not elected in Dublin. It appears to be playing some sort of sleight of hand with tents, yes, which is very amusing. Probably less for the people in those tents and less for the people who live beside where those tents are turning up. But it turns out that migrants have a sort of fluid nature to them, Michael.
Really?
It's like trying to hold liquid in your hand. And when you take a load of tents and move them elsewhere, they're capable of looking around and going, oh, no, I don't like it here. I'm going to go back to where I was. And then when you tell them it's illegal for them to go back where they was, they move slightly away from where they were and just set up tent shanties there.
Yeah, I think there's a touchy naivete, but there's the surprise of the government authorities discovered that migrants are, in fact, mobile people. That having got here from Bangladesh or from sub-Saharan Africa, getting from Sogart to the Grand Canal isn't the incredibly difficult and challenging thing that they had obviously thought it would otherwise be. And as regards the legality of it, telling them it will be illegal, well, there was they possibly had a sense that when they came into the country with either without documents or having got fake documents and then destroyed them on the plane or given them away to someone and come into the country with no doc, that the legality or not of coming back to where they've been sleeping in their tents, and also perfectly happy to take the tents off the nice people giving out the tents. Must be decent business in tents at the minute.
It must be quite good. An out-of-season business, which is very valuable. I would imagine there is a part of the government which, every time this happens, is just looking quietly at charities going, please stop giving them tents.
Yeah, I mean, there's that moment that you think, yeah, lads, could you just stop doing that? Just, I know, but really, just ease off.
So it's going to be a very good situation for the first candidate for the European elections in Dublin that runs on a simple no shanty towns beside where your children go to school platform.
Yeah, I think that's a decent platform. I think it would do well even in St. Mary's Road and Ballsbridge these days.
You wouldn't have thought it'd be an effective policy platform for any candidate in any first world country, but it is where we are.
No Bidonvilles in your location. Yeah, but you said there that the government are doing their best for the local in Dublin for the local. And you have to say, God bless them. They really are. I mean, all those independents that are running out there. It's like they have sat down with Regina Doherty and said, now, Regina, I know it's going to look a bit odd. It's going to look like, you know, we haven't really got the hang of this. But don't worry. We have polling. And it tells us that, you know, this is the way to get our core vote out. But you know what? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I mean, you won't feel any regret. Because they are doing their very level best. There was a comedy. Did you not think there was a kind of a touching comedy about putting the sign up saying, by the way, Once you've left here, it would be illegal for you to return to Mount Street. If nothing else, for the implication that, there are no, if you can't return to Mount Street, then they won't know where to go. They'll have to stay in Saugerties because the only other street they know in Dublin is Mount Street.
I did like the aspect of a sort of, well, we've told them it would be illegal.
Yeah.
We've done everything we can here. You're like, what if they ignore the sign, though? And this incredibly, how could you just, it's a sign, though. You can't ignore that. That's the height of authority.
And we wrote it in Georgian and Albanian and everything. So, I mean, what more could you
Much like
do?
Rhetoric O'Gorman inviting people to the country.
Promising them a key to their front door. It's lovely.
So on the actual poll that was out today, some interesting movements. Sinn Féin 29 plus 3, Fine Gael 19 minus 2, Fianna Fáil 16, no movement. Social Democrats 6, no movement. Green Party 4, no movement. Aintu 3 minus 1. Interesting, as they just had their Ardesh and they've been in the media a bit recently.
Yeah.
Labour 3, no movement. Solidarity People for Profit 2, no movement. Independents and Others 19. Two. So Independents and Others are one good poll away from overtaking both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
At this stage, running into whatever we are now, what, 4 and a bit weeks away from the election, we're going to be seeing a lot of polls and it's going to get a bit tedious. But okay, this is the second poll in a short space of time, which has shown Sinn Féin going up, which is interesting.
Yeah, Sinn Féin have, as was going to happen, they have, should we say, Michael, amended slightly some of their stances on things like immigration.
They have shown that they can be flexible and respond to the operant conditions of the political reality and move. Now, have they really? Or have they found a formula of words that people at the top feel comfortable saying? And what's actually happening is the people who are working on the ground and going door to door are saying some a slightly telling a slightly different story, and maybe a story that wouldn't go down brilliantly at HQ level, but is working getting through. Now they've certainly changed the music. They've changed their music. They've changed the nuance. They changed the tone. I'm not 100% sure that they've changed their hearts, Gary, deep inside.
Well, Michael, who amongst us can look into the hearts of men?
Well, no, indeed, this is true. And if they can look into their own hearts, they're doing well. But yes, they have. It feels like, on the basis of these two polls, that strong sense of momentum away from them seems to have been halted. We have another 4 weeks. We'll see. There's time for them to misstep. Although, I wouldn't re if I was an op another a party running against them, I wouldn't rely on them making a mistake in order to save my bacon. I would be looking for other modalities for bacon saving.
I mean, Michael, it's nearly like there would have been some advantage in a very quick snap election in order to ensure that Sinn Féin didn't have time to get its act together.
You could say that, Gary. I couldn't possibly comment again. But yeah, you know what? In words that nobody ever thought they would say, anybody would ever say, when it comes to politics, maybe Bertie Ahern was right. Maybe Bertie Ahern has better political instincts even than Micheál Martin.
I think actually, Michael, I have an even more horrifying line for you.
Oh yeah.
I think Matt Cooper may have actually said something that was correct.
No, you sure this wasn't one of those deep fakes that the young people tell me about on the internet?
No, he put up an article titled Simon Harris's Early Missteps Make November 15 a Likely Election Date. Now, whatever about the election date, it just goes in on Harris. He says he's going to be the shortest serving Taoiseach in the history of the state, far shorter than he has stated as his immediate ambition. And basically, if I had to sum up what they think the problem here is, it's everything Harris has done since he failed to get rid of McEntee.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you see the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday?
No, I don't think so. What was it?
I only just happened on very passing by accident that apparently there was blood on the carpet in the cabinet room, and that there are members of the cabinet who are livid, and cabinet colleagues. This is the headline, I think. Cabinet colleagues blast juvenile and bombastic Simon Harris. Dem's fighting words.
Yeah, not to put too fine of a point on it, Michael, but they did just elect this man.
Yeah, they did. He was elected indeed by acclamation. There was nobody else in Fine Gael, apparently, who could do the job. And then Fianna Fáil and the Greens went through the lobbies and voted for the man.
Yeah, and you know, Fianna Fáil did not, for instance, take the opportunity to cut him off at the knees and therefore separate themselves from any mistakes he might make, which he generously responded to by immediately starting to make mistakes. The polling that was done, the polling, it comes from Ireland Thinks, it was for the Irish Independent. It included one of my favorite metrics in Ireland, which is the personal satisfaction rating. I don't know, these are utterly unimportant, but for political parties, particularly people around those who are being polled on this, treat them as if they're popular. So you constantly get this, oh, well, Fianna Fáil's leader, Micheál Martin, is extremely popular, and therefore the fall in the party cannot be his fault. Stuff like that. But here's the Simon Harris has a score on the personal satisfaction rating, which is basically going to people and going, yeah, how satisfied are you with their performance, of 4.3. Micheál Martin has a score of 4.6, and Helen McEntee has a score of 3.3. Now, you might look at that and say, okay, really good on Micheál Martin's side, Harris doing pretty well, McEntee near the middle of the pack, but, you know, it could be worse. And that is an understandable view until you learn the next piece of information. Those are graded out of 10, not 5.
Yeah, no. Also, they always do this thing with Micheál Martin. Oh, look, he's actually the most popular of leaders. He's passed by Mary Lou McDonald in his approval ratings. He's up at 44%, whatever it is. So it's not his fault. I think it's the other way around. I think the fact that he's that popular and yet it's not having an effect on the party's popularity indicates that maybe it is precisely his fault. That he's appealing to all of these people who will never vote for Fianna Fáil, but he's not appealing to the people who might vote for Fianna Fáil. And that seems to me to be a fairly substantial error for a political leader to make. But that's just one man's opinion.
Yeah, I would also point out that this, yeah, it's a matter of relative
Oh yeah,
popularity
relative, yeah.
as opposed to people actually liking you.
Yeah, these are not the same figures that Lincoln got 2 days after the funeral.
No, so McEntee has continued to have just a terrible period. I've never seen a minister so dedicated to looking, you're absolutely incompetent, but I have, it has, Michael, given me sort of a grudging respect for McEntee, because I have never seen a politician so determined not to die. I mean, McEntee has had multiple scandals which would kill a lesser politician, but by simply refusing to acknowledge the reality of your situation and moving forward inexorably, she's been able to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, and I know a lot of people somewhere in the world anyway, I'm sure the metrics are available for Ireland, have seen on different platforms the video of Micheál McNamara, Michael McNamara, interviewing her, shall we say, in the Dáil committee. You didn't have to be a softie to be at the after 5 minutes to start actually genuinely unsarcastically, unironically feeling a little bit sorry for her because it was just so bad. It really was epically bad.
All I could feel when I was watching that was just, where are her advisors? How did no one brief her on this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was told by one insider that some of the stuff that they were looking for was just really hard, and the problem was they would have to say they didn't have the numbers and give the reason why they didn't have the numbers would actually uncover an even bigger problem within the way the numbers are collated and the lack of internal discourse there is between different departments, and that would be a worse admission even than saying, well, sorry, we just don't have them. Also, that apparently the department has lost a number of its best people over the last little while. And that this department is apparently in a little bit of a state of chastise at the moment. I don't know. Anyway, there are lots of other reasons other than just her. But I don't know. The weirdest commentary I saw about when I get back to the McEntee herself in a minute was people giving out about haranguing the minister like this, and this was only going to give succor to the far right, who are going to put videos of this up and stir up anti-immigrant sentiment and stuff. I think the one thing that Michael McNamara didn't do was shout or berate or harangue her. His questioning was forensic, but it was polite and measured. There was nothing about it, of a harangue about it at all. I thought it was the weirdest political take.
It would have been less devastating for her had he been more aggressive, as opposed to being very careful to say, this is the department, this is not you, but you should know this. And it was very like, I'm being quite pleasant to you, which on video made it so much worse to look at, because you can tell that this is someone not trying to get her. It's just, shall we say, Michael, a demonstration of the gap between one's confidence in one's position and one's actual capabilities.
Yeah, and that's the question, isn't it? When she's, how much awareness does Helen have of what's happening around her? And how much does she ascribe to outside factors and malign actors? Or does she have any sense of her own role in this? I mean, we're told that she lobbied very, very hard in order to keep the job, that she brought in some heavy hitters, people with relationships to Simon Harris, so that she would keep the job. She really wants the job.
I mean, she has a perfect excuse to go, though. Use the bomb threats as a reason to go for personal reasons. And it's like a kind of crappy meal, Michael. Like, you ended on a high enough note, like a good enough dessert and wine course.
Yeah.
People tend to focus on that. Where if you were to go, listen, whatever about this, the bomb threats to my family house, we've had multiple of them, I've had to evacuate my wife, my husband, my children. I don't want to continue, given the impact it's having on that. You could get a great deal of sympathy from that. You could move somewhere lovely, like Foreign Affairs or something like that. I'm sure something would be found in the moment because the PR would be so good.
Higher education.
And people might forget about your astounding incompetence.
Yeah, you do the bomb and then you'd say that the problem is, as committed as I am to the department and much as enjoying this, the challenges, it has now become a distraction both to the work of the department and to the wider government. And I can't accept this in the threats to my family. So I have sadly, blah, blah, blah. And off you go. But no, she is barnacle-like, sticking to the side of that rock or to the side of that ship. And I just wonder if that ship may be named Titanic at this stage. And Helen is going to play her own little role in bringing that ship down.
Yeah, I mean, I did hear some of the Fine Gael saying, well, you know, we need to keep her because we needed the McEntee machine around Meath to deliver votes there. And all I could think was, how many votes do you think Helen McEntee, if this European election becomes effectively a proxy for a referendum on immigration, how confident are you that McEntee is going to generate you votes as opposed to being a massive liability? And then you have, like, immediately after that, you have the story about the sex offender who we are told, because it was before the High Court, a chap came into the country. McEntee's agents were told that he was a sex offender and apparently did not tell this chap that he had to register as a sex offender in Ireland. So the chap had no registration, which meant obviously he couldn't be watched or classed as someone as a sex offender because no one from the minister's office bothered to actually do anything with that information. And that comes for a really bad time for her because all of the questioning of why her office isn't doing other things, basic things that they should be doing. And now it turns out, oh yeah, even when we're told that someone is a sex offender, we just don't bother making sure they actually register.
No, sorry, on this one, because you can clear up some of the stuff about this. Okay, he comes in, he's a sex offender. My understanding is that they were informed of this, but they didn't, I don't know, maybe there is no action to take specifically on that, on the foot of that information. They didn't tell him that he had to register. Okay, but what else do we know that they knew or didn't know? Like, he applied for asylum in Germany. Well, no, he applied for asylum in Italy, was refused. Then he goes to Germany and he's refused. He goes back to Italy and he's refused again. Where does he go?
No, this is a separate case, Michael.
Oh, no. Oh, sorry. Oh, this is a different one.
Yeah, but no, this is a different sex offender.
Oh, sorry. Go on. No, tell me.
So this This relates to the case of the High Court judgment, which struck down the state's ability to return asylum seekers to the UK. So the guy in that case was the sec was a sex offender,
All
and when
right,
he came
sorry.
here from the UK,
Right.
we were notified in October of 2021 that he was a sex offender. On the basis that we would then, go to him and get him to register in this country for reasons of public safety.
Yeah.
And, the British can't do it, so the best thing they can do is tell us. And, we do. Seems fairly basic. And yeah, here's the problem though. They noted that on his file, but then it was only in December of 2023 that they noticed that they had put it on his file and started inquiring with their counterparts in the UK as to. So what was the actual offence?
So that was the first time they noticed that this was on the file, and then they went back to the Brits and said, "Oh, by the way,
Yeah.
what? Okay."
And here's the thing to remember, Michael. This was after he had brought legal proceedings in the High Court, the case which would, in the end, ensure that we couldn't class the UK as a safe country. So they were looking at his file several months after he brought a very important legal case against him. So two questions there. One, you would think you would have looked at it prior to that at some point, perhaps when the legal case was brought, or perhaps shortly after you were told by the UK that he was a sex offender in a perfect world. And also, the second point, if he hadn't brought the legal case, would they have ever noticed? And this goes back to what GRIPT has been saying for a long time. When the government says that asylum seekers are vetted, that they're checking fingerprints and names against international databases, they are not, as a matter of course, checking for records of criminality. They are phrasing it in such a way that a member of the public would think they are. I think they are being deliberately misleading. But when we reached out to some of the databases and asked how often have Irish Immigration Services or police asked to see, given you a name or a reference and asked to see if that person has a criminal record, we were told they've never done so.
Right.
Also, Michael, not to be unfair to McEntee, this is a minister who has tried to use as her sort of, statement her North Star, the issue of sexual violence. So it's not a great look
Yeah.
to just not be, doing this. It also raises the question of how many more people are in this situation. Like, how many sex offenders are there in the country, whether that's at the lower end or rapists, who McEntee and her people have been informed of and just haven't bothered to actually register them? Which, again, for a Minister of Justice, is perhaps not a great look.
So then the other guy, that's a whole other case.
Yeah, that's Muhammad.
Imaginative thinking on his parents' behalf, but go, okay.
Well, you want to get all of the spelling variations.
Okay. So how what was his particular sort of itinerary? How did that work?
He claims to have fled from Somalia. He has a particular interest because of he was just jailed for an attempted rape of a woman in the toilets of a Dublin bar. I'll give you the subheading of the Irish Times reporting on this, Michael.
Right.
Muhammad, 26, asked the woman why she was screaming during the attack and told her, "I am saying please." The court heard the woman scream so much during the 90-second attack that she lost the ability to scream or use the high-pitched register of her voice for months afterwards. Now, he pled guilty to attempted rape and sexual assault. No known previous convictions. Now, the interesting thing here, of course, is how he got here, Michael. And that is not a great look for the government either. So he has been here since February of 2022. He applied for asylum. His asylum application has not been decided. But here's the thing. He fled Somalia in 2017. So there's 5 years of his life where you might go, well, where was he? Well, he was touring Europe. So he was in, this is according to the Irish Times, he was in direct provision in Italy before being refused asylum in Germany, Italy, and France. He then travelled to the Netherlands, where he got a false Swedish passport, which he destroyed while travelling to Ireland. Now, again, we are told these people are being checked against databases, and they have been explicit that they're being checked against databases which will say if these people have previously applied for asylum in other European countries. And yet, this chap, who had been refused asylum in three separate European countries, travelled here on false documents and destroyed them, was able to come into the country and then spend a great deal of time here without any decision being made, and then, attempt to rape someone, which overall, kind of a cavalcade of failure.
Yeah, it's not a great look, is it?
It's not a great look on its own, but each one of these cases highlights specific things that the government have said they are handling in a way that indicates, actually, no, you're not. Not at all. How is this happening? How does this keep happening?
Yeah. And we're finding these things. Maybe we're coming across the only instances where these problems have occurred. And you're also left wondering, well, if we found these instances, how many other instances have in fact occurred? How many more of these people are out there unknown and unbeknownst to the communities in which they're living? It's not a great look. Listen, I mean, we're flogging horses that are long since dead at this stage, because it's clear, and it's clear from the internal documents, it seems that the system here is broken. And you know what? It was never designed, I think, maybe other countries have. Our system was never designed to deal with this kind of context and these kinds of numbers and this kind of situation. It's just not up to it.
And then in the same week, Michael, because all of this has come to light in a week.
Yeah.
We also had the story from Ken Fox, the investigative journalist. He's a specialist in FOI. And the headline of that, it was in the Irish Times a few days ago, justice officials warned McEntee of Rwanda policy knock-on effect as early as 2022.
Yeah.
And yet nothing was apparently done to deal with it. However, that story had a very interesting kind of point at the end of it. Because this is a point that we've brought up with McEntee and government ministers repeatedly, and they've always denied it was an issue. And that's the issue of exit controls. Basically, we've argued that Ireland doesn't have any. We assume people we've told have to leave have to go. And McEntee has taken this incredibly naive approach of, well, if they're not claiming social welfare and they can't work legally, they must have left the country. Which,
yeah,
it might shock you to know this, but criminality does exist. And Ireland has both a black and grey market in it of considerable size. But here's the interesting part of this story. This is the last paragraph of it. There were also questions over whether some of the people subject to older deportation orders were even here anymore. Ireland is not in a position to ascertain who has left the state, as it has no exit controls. Now, that was in a briefing to Helen McEntee. So Helen McEntee has been briefed by her civil servants that we cannot ascertain who is still in the country, but has spent a great deal of time denying that that's the case.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, Gary, it's not as if this we are having to invent all of this and that these are problems which were unknown or unpredictable, because 30 or odd years ago, for example, the Italians, when the first great wave of immigration coming in across the Mediterranean was occurring, the situation in Italy was, if you were found and you were taken in by the police and you didn't have correct documentation and you hadn't applied for a right to remain under any heading, what you're doing, you're given 14 days to leave the country and then you were released. And it became very clear very quickly, Gary, that that wasn't actually working. That telling people, okay, you jolly well, now for a lot of people it did, because actually most of them who were coming into it at the time didn't really want to stay in Italy. They were on their way to Germany. At the time, Germany was still the great sort of draw in Europe. And I think some of the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, had already started to appear on the radar for people coming in. But for large numbers, they just, you will also be surprised to discover that Italy has a large black and grey market, because nobody ever heard of that before. And a lot of these people just simply disappeared into that and stayed. And then occasionally they would be picked up in unconnected activities by the police. And they say, well, you were supposed to leave. Oh, I didn't. So this kind of thing has been dealt with in other countries in other times. And we know it doesn't work. And any reasonable person, fair as Gary, would know that why would it work? Why would you leave? I mean, you or I were in the situation of an economic migrant or any kind of migrant, frankly, coming from sub-Saharan Africa or from South Asia or wherever. And we've got here. If you can survive, if you can get yourself a job of some kind, a way of supporting yourself, why would you leave? Particularly when people are telling you, if you can stay long enough, even if it is illegal, the chances are if you're here long enough, they'll let you stay.
Just want to give you, Michael, just as a general example of how the news cycle is going for the government. Just a list of the front page headlines of the Irish Daily Mail over the last while.
Okay.
Okay, here's the first one. Hospital was like a war zone on night Aoife died. That is in relation to the absolutely unnecessary death of Aoife Johnston at University Hospital Limerick.
Yeah.
A horrific case. She died in great pain, effectively waiting for medical care at the hospital with her parents there. The inquest was horrific. Not a great story for the government, I think we could agree. The next day is not in control of immigration. Most voters don't believe government is on top of crisis, poll finds. The next day is ministers given stark warning to cut back now. Confidential memo reveals 2.9 billion euro overspend in five departments. The next day is I never got to say goodbye to my little sister. Family welcomes coroner's verdict as doctors say the ED still dangerous. That is again in relation to the Aoife Johnston case. Then we get bomb scare at McEntee Home. Then we get UK won't take back migrants. Diplomatic row erupts. Then we get zero migrants sent back to the UK. No refugees have been returned to Britain in 3 years. Then we get judge troubled by justice's handling of migrants' case. High Court criticizes department for failing to inform refugee in trial that sparked diplomatic row. He needed to register as a sex offender. Then we have end of tent city. Then we have UK's Rwanda plan a risk to Ireland. McEntee was warned. Minister briefed 2 years ago. Then we have bid to send migrants back to UK pointless. McDowell warns legislative quick fix to return asylum seekers would breach EU law. And then we have ex-Taoiseach to get 24-hour armed Garda protection. As news cycles go, Michael, that's not very good. In fact, I would struggle to think of a more negative period for the government.
The closest thing that comes to a good news story for the government in that cycle is bomb in McEntee's house.
Not to be unkind, Michael, but when someone threatening to kill your justice minister and her family is the high point of your news coverage, because at least people might think that's sympathetic, it's not a sign of a government doing well.
Also, I mean, frankly, end of tent city is a really bad headline. When the ne when if it's not the next day, 2 days later, the headline might read "Tent City Back."
I would also note the subheading of End of Tent City is, but 1,600 more migrants came in the past month. And then the second part of that front page was about the Garda Commissioner requesting 100 extra speed cameras.
Because that's what everybody's worried about. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't handle immigration, and also you're putting in place a ton more speed cameras.
Yeah, and I saw that at least somebody's suggestion was the speed cameras were going to go on the motorways. The people in charge of making these policies, I'm sure, are very expert in these policies, but it just seemed odd to me because the safest roads in Ireland are the motorways. In fact, the Irish motorways are some of the safest roads in Europe and in the world. So why particularly we should be concerned about those when that's not where people are dying? But there you go.
It's about doing things, Michael.
No, Gary, it's not. No, it's not about doing things. It's about looking like you're doing things.
So just to go into more detail on the poll, because it did contain a lot more than we previously talked about. I suppose the issue is of immigration, to start with, how many people class it as the most important issue. In 2022, Michael, 5% of people classed it as the most important issue.
Yeah.
In this poll, 41% of people classed it as the most important issue. It is climbing, and it is not climbing slowly. In April of this year, Michael, 26% of people thought it was the most important issue.
I have never seen a graph of concern like it. It's absolutely bizarre. First of all, that any subject hits 41% outside of an absolute particular crisis is, I mean, 41% as number one, that's a huge number for concern. But for something to go in the space of 2 years from a 5% to 41%, and then the jump even within this year is incredible. It's almost unprecedented. I don't get the sense that they have heard this or they have absorbed it. Maybe they think, and maybe they're right, that actually this is a headline figure, but maybe it's a bit like a health figure. People say they're very worried about the healthcare system, but that's ultimately not what they vote about. I think they would be wrong, because I think that there is at least an element, which is very unfortunate, of this concern, which is manifesting itself in a form of resentment and a sense of unfairness. And we know, Gary, from history, these are very powerful motivators when it comes to voting.
No, I mean, housing is still at 54% the number one issue.
Yeah, but Gary, let's face it, neither of these two subjects are not unconnected. Housing and immigration, it seems to me, are, you take away one, you solve one, you solve the other.
Yeah, they're clearly interlinked. On the point of resentment, you and I have been talking about experiences on the ground that there seems to be a mass of people, reasonable people, who are just pissed off and angry.
Yeah.
Deeply, deeply angry. And I've been chatting to people since basically the canvassing for the locals and the Europeans has, you know, kicked off properly. It is happening. It's going on. Even though it's not in kind of the height of it. And what I've been hearing from people is that the experience on the ground is really unpleasant. People from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, and even the Sinn Féiners who don't have or the right reasons, and even some of those who do, or the right views on this in the minds of the public, are getting butchered. Like, it's apparently just not good on the ground.
That's absolutely. I did a bit of a vox pop over the last week or so, talking to Fine Gael friends around the country, and I asked them what's the, and they said, well, it's a lot of hostility, not massive. I mean, these are Irish people. At the end of the day, they tend to be fairly polite. I heard there were two interesting stories. I thought one was, yes, immigration is constantly coming up; they're getting in the neck. I was talking to somebody not from Fine Gael, who was running in the West, and he said he had to reprint. After a week of canvassing, he had to go back and reprint his leaflets because he hadn't actually mentioned immigration at all on his leaflet. And after a week of canvassing, he said, I'm sorry, I can't go around with a leaflet that doesn't mention it, because every single door I go to is talking to me about this. The other curiosity was, while immigration was an issue for the Fine Gaelers, they all said that they were getting constant needles about the bottle return scheme, of all things. That people seem to be really, really annoyed at a kind of a peevish low level about the bottle return scheme. They say, first of all, I have this, particularly in rural areas, everybody has their bins. They said, I have a bin out there, which is for recycling, which I pay for. Why can't I do that? And then I get the bottles up, and by the way, they have to be in perfect condition. If they get dinted or dinged or whatever, then that I can't use them. And what the hell is that about? And then I go into the machine, and more than half the time, the machine doesn't work. Either it's malfunctioning, or if it's full, or I don't know. But I have to bring the fuck things back, and I leave them in the car boot, and then I have to keep remembering. And people are really, really annoyed about it. I mean, I remember thinking at the time that the problem with this was, if it didn't work seamlessly, I mean at a functional level, that it had all of the potential to be a small stone in a shoe that every week would just get a little bit worse. And that seems to be what's happening. And I, of all the things to do to annoy, to get to lose an election over, the decision to put in recycling machines, it just seems like such a small thing. But that, on these things hang the results often of elections. But that doesn't work. But yeah, they're all saying they're getting into the neck about immigration as well.
The Yeah, so they're having a real bad time on it. There was also a wonderful example of our discussion, Michael, of the factions inside Sinn Féin, how difficult it is to keep that show on the road, and how issues like this are not good for them because once people start kind of questioning, I just it's bad. But there was one question which was asked, which I thought really showed, shall we say, the inherent contradictions within the system, and it was this. Do you think there should be checkpoints at the border with Northern Ireland in Ireland to limit the number of asylum seekers coming here from the UK? 50% of people said yes, including 52% of Sinn Féin supporters.
Yes, 52% of Shinners want a hard border. You really couldn't make it up, could you?
I like the idea of a very Republican Sinn Féin leadership looking at that and trying to work that one out.
Yeah, how do you parse that one? I don't know. You don't. I think you just leave it alone.
And the weird thing is that one would assume, based on the demographics of the various different voting blocks within Sinn Féin, that the ones who agree with that are the more Republican Sinn Féin voters.
Yeah, on the basis that the more progressive ones are going to be the ones more likely to be open border people.
But they also have 37% against it. So this is the problem. How do you keep that in the show? Because it's you see similar things with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, more towards yes, but a large percentage of no. The difference, I would suspect, is that in Sinn Féin, the feelings on it are far more virulent, both against it because of the Republican angle and for it because of the socio-demographics of the voters. So I think it's not a good place for them to be. In relation to the question about what are the you know, what are the two top two issues? Which is an interesting way of doing it, actually. They ask which of the following issues should be the two most important priorities to deal with. Housing is up there, immigration is up there. Rise of the far right, Michael, at 11% plus three.
Yeah.
Given that immigration went up 15% in that period, I don't think that's that's the numbers they would like to see. Climate change, eight minus one. Israel-Hamas war, 3 minus 2. Russia-Ukraine war, 1 minus 1.
Yeah, it's very much home politics, isn't it?
I mean, cost of living comes in at 25 minus 2. Healthcare, 29 minus 2. It's all of these kind of very, you know, equity-focused kind of things. Climate change, poverty and inequality. All of that just sliding. Just sliding away.
Well, I think it's a crowding out effect, isn't it? It's not necessarily that
I
people are
think
becoming
so.
less concerned about those things that they individually, but rather that immigration and housing are just becoming ramped up and ramped up and more magnified in people's minds, and they're just crowding out all the other issues.
There's also the question of should Ireland join the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, which is currently at no 31, yes 36, don't know 33. There has been a lot of pushback against this bill, or sorry, this pact in terms of Ireland. It's been quite an interesting discussion. I mean, discussion is building it up beyond what it was. I think that my personal feelings on the migration pact is that there's a lot of positive stuff inside it. There are questions about the suitability for Ireland, because a lot of it was designed to deal with issues that are primarily impacting on the Schengen area,
Yeah.
and Ireland isn't in the Schengen area. And there's questions about some of the redistribution mechanisms and whether or not that makes sense for Ireland. I think a lot of the arguments against it have been incorrect or overblown. I think a lot of the sovereignty in this issue has already been passed to Europe. I don't think that's a runner. It's also, by the way, not a very liberal piece at all. This is designed largely to deal with the rise of ID in the ECR in the European Parliament, and because groups like the EPP are just getting slammed from their right on immigration all over the continent. This is quite strict in a lot of senses. The problem there, I think, Michael, is twofold. There are obviously issues with it that we should have a discussion about in relation to whether or not they're suitable for Ireland or whether or not Ireland should stay outside and deal with certain aspects of it, and do it that way. Which I think is compounded by the fact that I don't trust the government on this at all. I do not trust McEntee to discuss this with any level of competency or to negotiate anything that's required at any level of competency. And as seen, our deportation system is largely non-functional. So one does have to ask what would the impact of this be, not in a well-functioning state, but in a state which has no capability to do this work itself and seems to be suggesting, oh, well, sure, we should just sign up to it and everything will be better. So I suspect where this, I know it's not going to be put to a referendum, but people are calling for it, and I suspect I would vote against it on that basis, purely because of the ineptitude of the Irish government and their unwillingness to actually discuss what is inside this pact. But there's definitely good stuff in here.
I'd say the 33% who don't know are probably are the ones on the money. From talking to some of our friends in Europe, it seems to be that it is considerably tighter than what has gone before. It's a response and to the upcoming threat. The reality is that there's a sense that after the next European elections, the grand coalition that's operative now will be defeated, and the next, shall we say, governing coalition within the parliament will probably be made up of the EPP, the Christian Democrats, the Liberals, and the ECR, say. So it'll be a concern. So they're saying, listen, get this through now, because if you don't, even something really harsher and more horrible will be coming down the line. I have two questions about it. One is, this was voted for in packages, piece by piece by piece, in the parliament. And this is a purely technical question, which I do not know the answer to. It's just a question for anybody out there who might know. We, under the Amsterdam Treaty, as I understand it, and my understanding may be deeply flawed, we have this opt-in clause that we can opt into individual pieces of legislation, which we have tended to do when it comes to, say, justice, home affairs, and then issues around Schengen. We can opt in. So I just as a question, do we have to accept the package in toto, or can we do kind of what in America they would call a line item, where we can take that and that and that, but if we don't like that, we can take that out. So that hasn't been talked about. It's been presented to all as a package in toto, rather than something that we can take parts of. And I don't know if that's the case. Secondly, there is the issue around GDP. Our GDP, it's 50% population, 50% GDP is how you would work out what the contribution of member states would have to be to the Solidarity Fund or the Solidarity Pact. Now, our GDP very significantly overestimates the actual wealth of the country. We come in at 245% of EU GDP. We're only behind Luxembourg on GDP figures. And say, if you look at the CSO, they use an adapted GNI figure now, which is gross national income, rather than the GDP figures to estimate the size of the Irish economy. So that's a technical point. The other thing is, and this is, I think, what you're saying, is we have no evidence at the moment that the government has either the will or the capacity to execute what we already have on the books. So it's, what difference does it make if you pass new laws and you introduce new restrictions if you're not actually operating within the ones that you have on the books now? Why should we believe that this will make any difference, that it isn't simply another form of theatrical performative politics? If you're not doing what you're doing now, there's no reason to believe that even if you bring in more draconian laws, that anything will change.
Well, I think that's also the thing. And as we know, there is a failure state there if you sign up to this and don't deal with it effectively. And on, you know, the balance of probability, Michael, it would seem like we will hit that failure state.
Yeah, and have consequences.
And I don't know, did you see McEntee's response when asked, you know, should we go for this? Or why were we going for this?
Well, I think, which response, go on?
Well, yeah. Well, it was in the same committee, the Justice Committee, all with McNamara and McDowell. And it was, to sum it up, just, well, you know, here are all these problems with it. Why would we do this? And she said that, well, if we're going to do this anyway, I don't understand why we wouldn't sign up for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just going to put it out there, Michael. In a potentially contentious piece of legislation, which has many technical aspects, sure, why shouldn't we? Yeah, or why wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Is not, I would argue, a compelling argument to sign up to an international agreement on migration.
Yes, I did hear that. And God, that was a bit embarrassing. I mean, for a minister in a senior and important position in the cabinet, justice, which at the moment is where it's all happening. Ah, sure, why wouldn't we anyway? God, it was kind of Pathetic, really. If you're going to say something like that, at least hide it under a salad of high-flown fancy language. But, well, sure, why wouldn't we? And shrug your shoulders. No, it's not really cutting it.
Yeah, so to give the exact to the exact quote as what happened here, she was asked by Barry Ward this question. Another criticism I have heard on the efficiency and timelines which are set forth in the pact is around why we cannot do that without signing up to the pact, leaving aside the advantages of signing up to the pact. What is to stop Ireland from implementing the same timelines in dealing with applications? To which the response is, Michael, why would we not opt into the pact?
And that's it.
She also says, that is my question here. We have seen, before Barry Ward clarifies, I think we should opt into the pact.
It's high flown intellectual debate, thrust and parry.
There is enough in this pact that the government could actually sell it as a partial solution to the immigration situation that we have, because it does contain, as we said, a lot of tightening of things. And you could make an argument that if the rest of Europe signs up to it, but we don't, then Ireland will become a more attractive location for asylum seekers
Yes.
and will actually draw in more of them as a way into Europe. Now, all of those can be dealt with. That's they're not, you know, there's no knockout punch there in terms of policy issues. But the government has been absolutely unable to make even those. And frankly, when I've heard some of the government officials talking about this, it doesn't seem like they know exactly what's happening or why it's happening or care to explain at the very best why it is happening.
No, I agree. I think that you could make a decent argument that migration and at the moment is a European problem. It's not an Irish problem. It's a and if you look at the places from where a lot of people coming into Ireland are coming from, they're not coming on direct flights or charter cruises straight into the country in many cases. They're coming from Europe. It needs a European solution. And if we stay outside, well, maybe that makes us more attractive. Possibly. I think that's an argument we could sell. But there's been no attempt to actually get into the detail of this and to tell people, well, actually, this could be a useful tool for us to use. But maybe they don't think, why would they spend their time and their effort on this? Because politically, there's nothing in it for them. It just ends up having them talking again about the problem of migration, and all that does is draw attention to the fact that this is a failed system that they are incapable of managing. But yeah, I think you could sell it, but
I've heard this sort of thing which is going around at the minute, which is we can't do anything on this because then it will be a gift to the far
far
right.
right, God.
And I think it's one ridiculous. Anything which is empowered more radical kind of anti-immigrant nationalist elements has largely come from the government. It has not come from, you know, implementing harder policies. It's come from refusing to implement policies. And there was an interesting question actually in the poll where they were asked how much certain things were blamed for an increase in migration and asylum. And the government was, more people agreed that the government was at fault for these increases than war.
More than war, okay. So the government is more responsible than Vladimir Putin. Okay. Well, you know what? It's an opinion. Listen, Gary, I think that we should draw to a close on that bombshell, as it were, on this fine and lovely May Bank holiday, and let the people out into the wild. We shall be back, and normal times resumed. Presumably, there are no more bank holidays going to be announced in Turin. And I'd wish the people a good and happy week, and we'll be back next Sunday.
All the best.